2.
And that scripture says, 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 2, David is talking to his son Solomon, and he says, "I am about to go the way of all the earth. Be strong and show yourself a man." So what I thought I would do to kind of get things started is talk about what's going on in that first part of 1 Kings, and then what's going on in that conversation between the king that is dying and the king that it's about to take his place. So when you open up 1 Kings 1, you notice right off the bat that David is old. He is shivering in bed. People are piling clothes and blankets onto him, and he can't get warm, and he's not very in tune with his surroundings. He doesn't know what's going on in his kingdom. People are coming into his bedroom saying, "Are you aware that you've got this son that you thought was going to be king, but this other son is trying to become king too?" And so this is really weird for a lot of people around David, because he's King David. He was the one who fought Goliath. He's the one that led armies into battle and conquered nations and cities. He was the one who killed wild animals when he was a young shepherd. But now he is just fading away. There's hardly anything left. And so for the first time in about 40 years, there's a big hole in the leadership of Israel. And so for something that we can think about with that idea, we can look to the teachers that we have been enjoying this whole week, and that we can enjoy past this week, if we get their contact info and keep asking them questions and making contact with them. They're not always going to be around for us, just like David was not always there for Solomon. So we've got to take advantage of teaching opportunities that they're giving us while we still can, every chance we get. So David's old. Something else that's happening in 1 Kings 1 is that Israel is really unstable. There's this guy named Adonijah, and he's a lot like his brother Absalom. He is handsome. He gets himself a chariot and guys to run in front of it. And if you go to chapter 1 in verse 5, it actually says in the text he exalted himself. And what happened because of that is there's confusion, there's division in the country. And so what does it mean to be strong and become a man? It does not mean exalting yourself. It means providing security and stability for the people around you, in your family, in your church, at your work, the people that you have contact with. Not to be in a position to throw your weight around. This is something that Jesus talked about in the book of Luke. In fact, Jesus is sitting at the Lord's Supper table in Luke 22, and his guys are still arguing about who's the greatest. And he has to say, look, the rulers of the Gentiles do that kind of thing, but not you guys. You guys are to give yourselves away. So let's look at this conversation between David and Solomon there in chapter 2. And again, the verse that this whole discussion is based off of is in verse 2. What did it mean when David said, "I'm about to go, so be strong and show yourself a man"? Well, I think verse 3 gives us three concrete things that actually meant. And the first one is, keep the charge of the Lord your God. What's a charge? Well, if I look over at Joshua, say, and I say, "Here, Joshua, here is a map to bury treasure. Keep it secret. Keep it safe." That is a charge that I've just given to him, that now he's got some responsibility to do something with that. So this charge is not coming from David in the text. It's coming from God. This is the charge of the Lord your God. What is the charge of God? Well, look at the next thing in verse 3. Walking in his ways. You know, in our culture, we are encouraged to look inside of ourselves to find out what truth is, what we should be doing in our life, what we should be believing about ourselves and the people around us. But what God keeps saying is truth comes from me. Truth comes from outside of you. You guys watch Disney movies? Pretty much the message of every Disney movie that's ever been made is follow your heart. like, you know, the original Mulan movie, you know, you get to the credits and that's the song as the credits are going down the screen. And think about this. How do we know when we have crossed the threshold from childhood to manhood? How do you know that you are actually a man now? You know, if you look at a lot of different cultures, they have a ritual that you go through. There's this line in the sand action that happens. Like if you're a Native American, maybe you go out and you shoot your first buffalo or your first bear and you bring home the claws. Or you go off by yourself and you have a special dream and then you come back to your village and talk about it. And then you're a man, according to them. Well, according to God, how are you a man? Well, it comes back to this, the second thing that he mentions here. You commit yourself to walking in the ways of the Lord. And it's interesting, in the New Testament, if you have been buried with Christ and you are walking in his ways, you are a man. Like Acts 8, verse 12, the Samaritans that got baptized in that verse, it describes them as men and women, not boys and girls. So that's God's line. And there's a lot more to say about that, but that's at least the starting point. The third thing that he mentions here in verse 3, after walking in his ways, he says, keeping his statutes, his commandments, his rules, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn. Why does he have to mention those four things? Why didn't he just say, just keep the law, Solomon? Why does he mention those four words that pretty much get at the same idea? Well, it's because he's trying to say everything that God has ever said in any passage has to be internalized and put into your heart and into your life. And what's neat about this passage to me is that this is not the first time David has had this discussion with Solomon. If you look in the book of Proverbs, Proverbs 4, Solomon, as he's writing the Proverbs, he's talking about what his dad taught him at the beginning of his life. Proverbs 4, 3 and 4 says, Solomon is saying, he's looking back and he's saying, when I was a son with my father, tender, the only one in the sight of my mother, he taught me and said to me, let your heart hold fast my words, keep my commandments, which were really God's commandments, and live. And so to the extent that Solomon did that, he followed the Lord, he built the temple, he served him for a while, he was displaying strength and manhood, but to the extent that he followed idolatry, married all these foreign women, and left his God, his strength and his manhood left him. At the end of Solomon's life, he looks a lot more like King Saul than he does his own father. So with that, I'll pass the buck.
So the quote is be strong and become a man. That's the instructions that Joe gave. It's kind of an interesting theme. Is strength connected with men particularly? Yes. So I'm asking that question. I'm gonna present some evidence one way or the other. So you probably heard the phrase, be strong and courageous. Psalm 27 says, be strong, let your heart take courage. So strength is very often in the text associated with courage. In fact, I think Moses is the first to say that in Deuteronomy, instructing Joshua. Joshua repeats that to the people near the end of his life. So it does seem to be a phrase specifically aimed at men in leadership roles, right? And that's the case with this example of David and Solomon. So I'm asking this question. I'm going to let you draw your conclusion. Is it especially a male thing to be commanded to be strong? Right, and I'm kind of not asking, are women not to be strong? That's not the point. Is it a command God emphasizes for men? Interesting, 1 Corinthians 16, clearly written to men and women, says, be strong, act like men. I think is the actual literal way that reads. So I think there is some, in fact, I look for a place where it said to a woman, maybe. And the only one I could think of was Mary, who an angel comes to her and says, look, something weird's going to happen to you, right? And what does the angel say? He says to her, fear not. You know what I mean? You might have thought that would have been an occasion where the angel might have said, be strong. But it does seem like it's connected with leadership roles and with the development of men in their role of leadership and examples to others. Now, the next verse in 1 Corinthians 16, let all things be done in love. So don't forget that part. But it is associated with courage, probably as often as any other word in the scripture. And I think that's something maybe uniquely possible that men can excel at. It's associated with other things. And Nathan's just described how it's associated with keeping the law and those kinds of things, which is interesting kind of courage, right? Do you have courage to keep the law, for example? But anyway, that's part of that. So I want to ask you the question, and maybe you have questions back to us. Is this unique to men? In what way is it unique to men? In what way is it especially needed by men, right? As part of their becoming. And you sense in that verb there a process, right? Not bring the clause back. I like that one. But rather, there's this growth into that role, becoming, and being strong is part of that. I have one other little point. What is strength? So I think the Deuteronomy account says, love the Lord with all your mind and help me with his heart, soul, mind. No, only three things. I actually wrote them down. I should get it. Heart, soul, and strength. That means it's different from your heart and different from your soul, right? In the New Testament, in Mark's account, it's heart, soul, mind, and strength. So strength's different from mind, different from heart, different from soul. What is it really? Or is it maybe a quality that overlays all those elements of our personality, right? Our attitude, our courage, our intellect, maybe even our physical bodies. Each one of those can be strong. We can be strong morally. We can be strong intellectually. We can be strong emotionally, stable. You understand what I'm saying? So that it actually overlays all these other things about us as opposed to being something separate, as those lists might imply. I'm just asking the questions. You have to figure it out. Actually, Gary's going to answer all of
them. Probably not. I don't know if this will wake me up or not, but I think I can talk loud enough if you can hear me holler. Look at Proverbs 16:32 if you want to. I don't know how many have your Bible. I want to think about what really shows strength. And we've talked about the courage we need, the toughness we need, but I think there's an aspect of strength that we largely overlook. Proverbs 16:32. He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who captures a city. It takes more strength to dominate your spirit than it does to conquer a city. We think so often, we're kind of tempted to the worldly view of strength. You know, and it's quite different than Jesus' view. Think about how Jesus responded to being personally attacked, slandered, beaten, slapped, mocked, without a word. He didn't respond with revenge. The world says the kind of strength a man needs is just pop them. You know, just knock their head off if they get in your way. You know, show you're really strong. And you think about the fallacy of that in a couple ways. One is, okay, so you're more a man if you can slug somebody harder than they can slug you. Well, how many men do you know that are strong enough to stop a rapidly flying piece of lead? You know, and how much strength does it take to pull a trigger? I mean, any weakling can do that. The very idea that physical strength or the ability to beat somebody up makes you strong, no. He who rules his spirit is stronger than the one who captures a city. Think about this. A lot of you guys know me pretty well. How many of you guys think I could just really beat you up if I wanted to? You know, I mean, you know that's not the case. And yet, you don't respect me or not respect me because of that. That has nothing to do with respect or what we see as manhood. So remember that the real strength we need is the strength to control ourselves, not the strength to dominate physically somebody else and put them in their place by packing a punch. All right, so we'll answer some questions. I'll let you guys start on.
Yeah, this question is, how do you respect an adult's accusation when you know it is wrong? Like, won't you say that it is wrong? So what I would say to you is live in 1 Peter chapter 2. In fact, Gary actually mentioned this just a minute ago. But in 1 Peter 2:21, he says about Christians, "To this you've been called. Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you can follow in his steps. He committed no sin. Deceit was not in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten. He continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He bore our sins in his body on the tree." So as Christians, we are called to suffer, but specifically, we are called to suffer in situations where we are accused wrongly, and we are not to punch harder than we were punched, as I think Marty's talked about in his class. We are to turn the other cheek, as Jesus did, because if you think about things that you're accused of or I'm accused of, that doesn't even hold a candle to what Jesus was accused of, and yet he was silent through that whole ordeal leading up to the cross. And so is it unfair sometimes, the conversations that we have with other people? Maybe so, but we are called to be like Jesus in this. Also, I will say this, since this is a question about respecting adults, it is important to remember that you're not their peer. Adults have lived longer than you. Hopefully, and especially if this is talking about your parents or those that are trying to guide you and shepherd you, you're supposed to remember that too, that we are to look up to and try to learn from those that are older and wiser than us. Do you guys want to chime in on that?
That's good.
So I have a question about, is laziness a difficulty at college? Deceptively obvious, how to combat that from a vantage point of desire to be a godly man? Yes, I think it is. Why is it? Oftentimes college is when you're for the first time kind of away from home. I taught college, I taught freshmen, and I could kind of see that they were stepping on a moving walkway, right? Whereas when they'd been at school, they had homework every night, they had a class every day, they covered the same thing multiple times through the week. In college, it isn't that way. Right, you meet maybe less than once a week, or once a week, or two times a week, or three, and it's up to you to go find the time to get the work done. And you know what I mean? You're moving fast. You don't review a lot. That's just the way college is. And so all of a sudden, all of those external kinds of turn the crank, get it done, alarm clock things, you know, are gone. And some of you guys that you know have been through that, you understand that, right? And you know, you're really at a crisis point in some ways. It's probably a sudden change for some people who have not really had to exert that discipline. I think it's a dangerous time because you're beginning to set habits and maybe you mess up and you kind of get used to that and you kind of head down a path that gets worse and worse. What Gary said about controlling yourself is harder than controlling the city is part of that, right? And I think you have to take extra effort to do what you would do. Almost imagine that your roommate is the one that has the problem. What does he need, right? He needs you to punch him out of bed, get an alarm clock set up, ask him about his homework. Maybe you find someone that can help you do that, put those external controls in place. But more important, begin to ask yourself all those questions and find ways of triggering the discipline you need to take advantage of that. I'm not sure it's quite on the topic of strength, but I think that kind of discipline is going to apply everywhere in your life, right? As you grow your intellect or as you grow your discipline in whatever area it is, that kind of regular exercise. I don't know. I always think of the analogy of working out, right? We talked about this in one of my classes. It's just a discipline, and you get used to it. And I want to say this. I'm not sure exactly how to say it, but it's about doing things that you don't want to do. They don't feel good, but you force yourself into it until it becomes a habit. That's the way habits are formed. So maybe that's a way to form strength.
All right, let me deal with a couple things here. I have two questions that say almost the same thing. I've done something wrong to someone. How do I go about that as a man under Christ? Because I need help. Let me illustrate with this is a story I tell a lot. This is a hard thing for me. I needed this. I was in a church when I first started preaching. I was in my early 20s. There was a couple in that church that were really, really, really nice to us. They were old couple. They were like our grandparents. They did everything with us and for us. They were so gentle, so kind, so loving. Felt very close to them. There was a man in the congregation who was he had a hard job. He was a strong, physically strong man and a leader. And it's somebody I really respected. It kind of scared me, but I respected him a lot. I liked him. Well, after church one night, we had a misunderstanding. We did not agree on something, and we didn't treat each other very well. And we left, you know, on bad terms. And that really upset me. I hadn't had a lot of confrontations like that. And I wasn't sure I'd really said or done the right thing, because I don't think I had. But I didn't know what to do about it. So I went to that couple. I thought they'd comfort me. I needed some comfort. I felt pretty stressed. For the only time I've ever seen them do this, when I presented it to Earl, he's been dead for years now, he said, "You need to go over there right now and talk to them." Like, I can't do that. He brought his wife in, told her the situation. Daisy said the very same thing. They both insisted. They prayed with me, and they sent me over there. I will tell you, I was literally trembling when I went up to that man's door. That was such an important thing for me. I needed to go and apologize. We needed to go and straighten it out. It was wonderful. Everything I imagined it would be, it was not. It was great. We completely resolved it. He treated me wonderfully. We needed that. I needed that. I haven't always dealt with situations like that. I still don't always deal with them like that. But the right thing to do is go and resolve it. Apologize. Be man enough to say, "I'm sorry. I did the wrong thing. Please forgive me." Most of the time, that will go better than you think it will. Whether it does or not, it's the thing a man does. And again, you know, I feel like I did the other night. I would love to talk to some of you guys one-on-one. If you need to talk more about any of those things, I'd love to help if I can and encourage you. One more thing. This is a little less emotional, perhaps. How do we be the man of the house while balancing kids and work, etc.? Let me suggest one thing. A leader does not have to micromanage. If you married a good woman, she's capable. You don't have to tell her every move to make. You don't have to stand over her or do everything yourself. You work together. You've got a job, perhaps. She's going to be taking care of things. You provide the insulation. You provide the fur, the structure, so that she's not crushed by pressure and things like that. You weather the storms. You take care of the hard things. But you don't have to intervene and decide every little move that she's going to make.
That's good. So this question is, how do I, as a man, phase out of being a child in my own actions? That's an interesting question, and I would be curious if you guys had thoughts on that too. The book of 1 Corinthians comes to my mind when I hear that question, because that's a congregation of men, people who should be of the age to be acting like men, who are acting like children. And so how does Paul in 1 Corinthians try to teach them the way of strength and manhood in their congregation? He teaches them the way of love. And what does love do? Love looks outward. Love sacrifices. Love does not say, "You pushed me in the street, I'm going to take you to court now." Love says, "Let's work it out." Love says, "Let's grow together, even though we're different." And so being a child means looking inward, being the receiver of somebody else's giving to you. I've got a 10-month-old child. Maybe some of you actually met him Thursday night. He was here over there. He doesn't know how to do anything. He can't do anything for himself. Jenny and I have to do everything for him. But as he grows and as he matures, He then looks out, and with training, he then becomes a servant to other people. That's what manhood, that's what strength gets at. It's not the only thing, but that is part of it. And so anything that you can do to look outside of yourself, to ask around in your family or your congregation, what are the needs that you have? How are you doing today? How can I help you? How can I pray for you? That's going to take you out of childishness into manhood.
I've been overhearing some of Scott's classes on the Proverbs. And if you think about what wisdom is in the Proverbs, it's listening to advice, right? It's taking correction and loving correction, right? It's control of yourself, setting your own boundaries, and those kinds of things. I think as a child, one question you might ask yourself is, am I just waiting to be told what to do, or am I asking for advice? Do I like this correction, right? What can I set as my own limits so that I don't have to have someone else set limits for me? And I'll tell you, as a parent, when a kid comes in and says, this is my plan, here's what I think I should do, what do you think about this? And it's a good plan and it represents discipline and it's the right thing to do. I think to myself, this guy's growing up. And that's what you're trying to get to, is the place where all the things that a parent's provided, just like you said, advice, is sought out as wisdom, not wait until it's, you know, pushed down your throat. And the same thing with the disciplinary thing. I'm looking for that maturity in a child, including things about laziness. You know, the kid shows I can get him, he can get himself up, right? That's a great thing, evidence of maturity. He can do his homework without being nagged about that. Don't you see how that represents a kind of strength that's obvious to the world? So it's not quite the answer, but how do I become? I think you begin to do those things and then you convince the world around you that you are growing up, gaining maturity. I like this question. I just have to do it. How does one gain courage even if I'm super nervous? Okay. I identify with that question.
Amen.
Some of you were in my class and that came up. Somebody asked about it. But right. Here's what one thought I had about that was this. I think if you start reading the book of Joshua, they're in a period of mourning for Moses, if I remember right. What, 30 days or something? And the 30 days was up. And I'm imagining Joshua thinking, what are we going to do? I mean, there was, you know, great concern about, you know, what will happen when Moses is gone as a leader. And God's a little bit gruff with him, it seems to me. He says, newsflash, Moses is dead. Right? I'm being a little facetious, but he kind of says, you know, hey, we got to get going here. But if you read what he says, he's not saying step up and take it on and do it all yourself. A theme in what he's saying is, and I will be with you wherever you go. I think that's a key to overcoming nervousness, is if we can be confident that we're doing the right thing. That's how we know God's with us, by the way, is when we know we're doing the right thing. There's somebody standing right beside you who's going to make it work out right. You may be embarrassed when it's all over, but somehow God's with you and he's making it work out right. And that's the story I get from Joshua. I know he was a great military leader, but I think when Moses died, he was struggling, maybe, a whole nation was, with some fear that their great leader of 40 years had gone and the power he demonstrated. Anyway, I'm rambling now, but you see the point. God is with you wherever you go. And that's a repeated theme wherever this phrase, be strong, shows up. Often it says, I will be with you. I think about that, you know, backup, for example, in other places.
Let me piggyback on that just to make a couple more comments. I mean, think about how many people in the Bible were in that situation. Think about Moses, how scared he was, how much he didn't want to go. Think about Gideon and a variety of others.
Yeah.
We all keep it secret. We don't like to tell anybody, but we all feel super insecure and inadequate and scared most of the time. I live outside of my comfort zone. I've gotten to the point where I'm not even sure where it is anymore. You know, because if I was in my comfort zone, I don't talk. I hate talking. I know I talk all the time. It's a contradiction. But I hate talking. And everything I do, I feel insecure about. But you have to serve. You have to love. You have to trust the Lord. It's not because we're overqualified, but the Lord is able to make something out of the feeble efforts of ours, just like he did with Moses and Gideon and others. And I think we just have to do what we can. And several of these are very meaningful to me and difficult. When you become an adult, how do you go about making your own decisions yet also respecting your parents? Now, let me say a couple things about that, because some of you aren't adults yet. You know, it's important that you act maturely in whatever part of life you're in and however your parents are treating you. You can act maturely and you can be mature before the Lord no matter how your parents treat you or don't treat you or whatever. Because those are choices you make in your own heart, in your own life. You can control your relationship with God and things like that. I would say as you become an adult, to make your own decisions while also respecting your parents, I would say the most important thing, in our culture at least, is to become self-sufficient. When you have the resources to be able to take care of yourself and you're an adult, then you can make your own decisions. Certainly when you get married, you need to do that. Leave father and mother and cleave to your wife. Maybe move far away from both sets of parents. I think that's a good idea for a while. But if you are dependent on mommy and daddy for everything you have, you know, they need to do this, they need to do that. Well, I mean, they're going to set the rules. There's conditions for their help. But when you're actually able to take care of yourself and are doing that, then you can be independent and still be respectful to your parents. You would be respectful at all times, but that doesn't mean you always do what they would have chosen that you do once you're an adult.
Real quickly, I wanted to tack on to the super nervous question. How do I gain courage in that kind of situation? How many of you would you say that Nehemiah was a good leader? You know, Nehemiah built, he led the effort to build the wall of Jerusalem. He did all these mighty things. But at the beginning of his story, while he's still in Persia, he's talking to the king. The king notices that he is sad because he's heard about Jerusalem. And the king said to me, Nehemiah 2, verse 2, "Why is your face sad, seeing you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart." Then I was very much afraid. This is the same man who would then move to a country that he'd never been to before and motivate these people who for more than 100 years had had crumbling walls around them. Just amazing to me. But Nehemiah was afraid sometimes. And it wasn't because he didn't have any plans. He talked to the king about the things that he was thinking, but he was still afraid. But how did he handle it? He prayed, he says in verse 4, to the God of heaven right before he made his requests to the king for the letters and the supplies that he needed to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild everything. And so praying to God, simple but practical, concrete thing you can do. As a matter of fact, I mean, to be perfectly frank, that's what I did right before this panel. I don't do panels very much at all. And so that was something that was practical for me. Something else that was asked is, how do you explain Proverbs 16:32? And I'll go ahead and just read the verse. "Whoever is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who takes a city." I think that's kind of been touched on already, maybe by Gary. That's an interesting idea to me. That the mighty people in the Old Testament scriptures, they led armies, they wielded weapons, they shot bows and arrows, and they did things in a mighty kind of way. You would look at that as strength, but you might not consider somebody not giving a response back to somebody else who just insulted him as mighty. But that's the way Proverbs describes that. Is if you rule yourself, that is better than, that's more powerful than if you wielded weapons to take somebody else.
All right. There are three here and probably some others that kind of touch on this idea that it seems like a paradox at first as I've read these. How can I combat internal selfishness in regard to having friendly relationships? So this idea of being friendly. Here's another one. How can I be less cold with people, with gentleness and comfort, those kind of things? Because those sound like opposites in a way. First reading, you know, that's the opposite of being strong. Here's one, being humble, walking with God. Is that strong in the eyes of the world? You see, all of those are about these qualities of gentleness and all that. My first reaction, which is not very complete about that, is that you know, the most secure people are the ones that are threatened at all. And they have probably less reason to be angry or reactive and can be more sympathetic because they're secure themselves. You notice that. I don't know if you're that way. Sometimes people get angry, guys in particular. Often that anger is an expression of insecurity, right? I don't want to be made to look bad, and so I'm going to puff myself up and show that. I think one of the keys to the kind of sympathy and comfort and softness and gentleness, and we covered this in my class, and gentleness, right, is to have the internal strength, really, to provide that gentleness without feeling threatened yourself. I think that is a key element of strength. I have another poorer answer, I think. Maybe you can take it or leave it. I think sometimes when we come across my problem in life, sometimes maybe harsh or cold or unfeeling or whatever, and maybe it's because it's true, maybe I'm waiting for the feeling before I just go ahead and do the right thing, take the action. You know, you've probably heard this idea of you act yourself into feeling a certain way. I think there are acts of kindness, words of kindness, attitudes, questions that you might not quite feel like doing, but you push yourself into doing it, and suddenly your emotions are drawn into that action. And you feel a kind of a kindness about things. So I think there is a strength that says, I'm going to try this. I'm going to ask somebody how they're doing. I'm going to detect that they're having a problem and go see if I can investigate that. I don't feel like it. I'm nervous. I'm not any good at this kind of thing, like panel discussions, right? But I'm going to go ahead and try to do it anyway and do my best. And maybe I'll grow to do it with the emotions that should come with it. The gentleness and the humbleness and the compassion and all of that that we need to have as men. And I think are evidence of strength, not the evidence of absence of strength. I think that's what that's about.
Amen. I've got a kind of a question a lot like that. Is it okay to show your strength in a way to attract people to your manliness? And again, it takes more strength to control your strength than to just, you know, try to show everybody you're violent and aggressive and take revenge. And it takes more strength to be kind and to be gentle, because we know that's not going to sell well. People are going to look down on us. Think about the strength Jesus had. You think about, I mean, he's up there on the cross, and they are just laughing at him and mocking him and doing all manner of stuff to him after all they'd done to him that night. You know, I mean, I got in some situations in school where I couldn't have beat the guy up that was trying to bully me, no matter what I wanted. I mean, I didn't have any choice about it. You know, if I'd have tried to beat him up, he'd have cleaned my plow. You know, but that wasn't Jesus' situation. Jesus had all the strength there could have possibly be. What if he'd have called those legions of angels? I've thought before, if I'd have been Jesus, I'd have grabbed all their tongues and yanked them out of their mouths when they were saying some of those things. But Jesus didn't. He had all the strength, but he limited it by his kindness and love and patience and his willingness to drink the cup in our place. And so real strength doesn't show off its strength. It doesn't have to. Real strength is able to do the right and best thing that God would want. Let me answer one more here, and then I'll give it back. I don't know. He said, if in the future the father leaves or dies, how can the son become the man of the house? I know that's sometimes a practical situation. And sometimes it's even when the father doesn't leave. I mean, sometimes you've got situations in which you're called upon as an older brother to provide some leadership at home. That's really difficult to do well. And I want to suggest one or two things. I've talked to different people about those kinds of situations. One is, a brother is not a dad. And so you can't do the same things as a brother that you could as a father. If you've got younger siblings, you've got to be very cautious about bossing them around and telling them what to do. You've got to be very cautious and controlled about that. Show love, show attention, show kindness. Coach them, but coach them from the same side. I think when you know, older siblings get in trouble is when they try to be the boss. They try to be the big shot at home. If you're kind to your siblings, no matter what your parental situation is, and you lead them with kindness and respect, that's a much better way to do that. I mean, obviously there are other complicating factors. And one other thing I would say, if you were ever in that situation, get advice from good, strong, godly men who know you well.
How do you be a strong leader and encouragement to your children? I'll answer that part first, and then I'll read the rest of the question. You know, if you're in my class, you noticed that we were looking at the qualities of God, and they kind of fall in three genres, if you will. His inherent qualities, inherent truthfulness, right? His inherent holiness. And then his benevolence, that is, he looks outward and he's sacrificial. These are things you develop as a dad. You have to be the right kind of person. That's the heart of the whole thing. So think about that. The rest of the question is during hard times. it seems like the character of the dad is going to be key to that. And one thing we talked about in one class was you think about something that might happen that's really terrible. I think you have to ask yourself, and only in a way a Christian can, how bad can it be? And it won't be forever. Right? And that is, nothing's going to happen. If you have that firm conviction, do you see that that's going to rub off on your kids? It'll be expressed really in the way you handle things and the way you talk about things. Second thing is that unselfish view. What do they need? What encouragement? What words? What kind of, provision really that could they deal with, help deal with the hard times? I don't know what the hard times actually would be. I'm assuming an emotional hard times, like a death in the family or some kind of a crisis or something like that. What do they need? Think of them. Show your unselfish attitude. And then the third area was just the area of competence. And that's the kind of thing where you develop it with practice. You're right. You've had practice comforting people. You found people that you could help in different ways. So you have some of the skills of knowing what to say and how to comfort people. So character, internal character, most important. Outward view, where you're not the one needing encouragement. You're helping others. And then finally, the skills to do that. If I could ramble just for a minute. We were thinking about maybe contrasting the idea of physical muscular strength. Or maybe even asking the question, is that important for a Christian man to be strong? And I'm talking about barbell strong. Maybe a better word would be dumbbell strong.
Amen.
Anyway. But you know, and I think I heard a little bit of this in the last class, Paul uses the image of an athlete getting strong, training to be in a contest, as a way to tell us how we need to live as Christians. You're aware of that? In 1 Corinthians 9, he says, you strive in the games. He says, they're disciplined in all things. That's the secret to getting stronger. It's not just wandering around thinking, how can I get stronger? It's doing something. In fact, it's kind of harsh and painful. Paul said, I buffet my body. I know there's a lot of puns made out of that. But I looked into that word. There's one other place I know that it's used, and it's the strangest place you'd think of. It's the unjust judge. You remember the widow that kept pestering that judge? And he says, I'll give her what she wants, lest she wear me out. And that's the same Greek word, that he wears out. In other words, it actually literally, I think, means bruise or something. That's the word that's often, it could be translated that way. This idea that Paul did stuff. Now, I don't think he was necessarily pumping weights and hurting, but he was doing whatever he did to the point that it was wearing him out. And was he getting stronger? Well, he says, yes, that's how athletes win, right? They don't just randomly box the air and other things. I mean, maybe a theme under all this discussion of strength is to get at it. Think about training. Think about things that would help that strength develop. Don't just sit and wish I could be stronger. And I've wondered, too, about how do we measure our strength? But that's for another time, maybe. What can I look at in my life and say, well, how strong really am I? What circumstances would help me measure that? I'm sorry for rambling, but I just felt like that passage needed to be brought up with regard to strength and athletic prowess and all that.
I'll take one here. How do I stop fighting? You know, think about why we fight. You know, I fight when I feel like I have to prove something. When I feel insecure, I feel overwhelmed, and I feel like I've got to come out fighting or else I'm going to get, you know, hurt, probably more emotionally than any other way. I mean, in practical terms, get away from the group that's fighting. Get away from the people who are doing that. But ultimately, be strong in the Lord. Be strong in ruling yourself. Gain your self-respect by the fact that you're serving God. You don't have to fight anybody to prove anything. And again, fighting proves nothing because you can't stop a bullet. I mean, if you escalate that to the logical conclusion, you know, nobody can stop that, and nobody, it takes no strength whatsoever to pull a trigger. So I think that's really important to control ourselves and submit to the Lord.
Come on, questions.
I'm too.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not sure I want to answer the other ones. You may want to. I can answer this one. But we didn't promise we'd answer everyone. When I become a man, what is the first thing I need to learn at the church? I mean, this is a progressive thing. You don't become a man at some point in time, and now I've got something else to learn. Just keep growing a little bit. Keep maturing. There are some teenagers who are more like a man in the Lord than some people who are adults, and vice versa. And so, you know, continue to grow in the Word. Continue to apply what David told Solomon. You know, live by the Word.
Yeah. Does the distance from family, this was easy. Does the distance from family, as in, you know, leave and cleave, and the relationships equal maturity? No. Okay, next question. No, there is actually a great question on here. It says, how do we identify and thwart the growth of false or toxic manliness? That's kind of a key phrase in our society. What is it called? Toxic masculinity. And it kind of comes out of the female world, I think, where they're saying, you know, men have a problem. Of course, we do have all the problems. And that is that we express, you know, this male character in a way that's violent, that's oppressive, that's intended to maintain our grip on power in some worldly sense. That's, I think, the way the term is used today. And I assume, I hope this question is really more about, you know, how do I identify it in myself and stop it? But it could be, you know, I'm not sure what we can do about society besides preach the gospel. I'm not going to try to go into political actions. I don't think that's going to help at all. But I think in ourselves, man, we need to be self-aware. One way to deal with that would be to help get the help of women or others who can tell us, how am I coming across, right? Is this offensive the way I've said that? That would be one way to do it. The other is just a self-awareness of my own attitude toward people, the way I talk. Am I trying to do... In our class, I hope you caught some of those things. One of our themes was to recognize the fact that we're male and those characteristics are coming out in the wrong way, right? So maybe a better awareness of that. Example of Jesus, other things come to mind that, you know, we could use as well. But that's a great question, and I think it's something we need to guard against. And Christians, we ought to stand out for our courage, but also our non-toxic masculinity, maybe we say. Yeah. And I'm sorry about the other question. Maybe I don't fully understand it, but just because you get married and you move away from home, that doesn't mature you at all. I mean, there's got to be a certain amount of growth and development before you're ready for that. Yeah.
I've got a question here. Basically, how do you correct a brother who's not making wise decisions carefully, humbly, prayerfully? I think we approach anyone in a humble, respectful way, and out of love, out of concern. And then it's going to depend on the attitude of the brother whether they receive that way. I'm done with the questions.
I'm done with questions I want to answer too.
Anybody have any other questions you want to ask?
If you ask other questions, you can come talk to us privately. I thought that went really well, and thanks for not asking too many questions.
Or hard.
I guess it's good. Well, that question came in. But I was just going to say, could you guys speak to these guys about figuring out what kind of work they need to be doing? Some of the wisdom you guys can shed on that, maybe them going forward. I don't know. Maybe that's too generic.
I mean, I'll say something about my perspective on that. Think about work that you can do relatively well, you have some ability in, and that there's a market for. You know, is there going to be a job in what you're trying to get a job in? Is it flexible enough that you can live where you would want to live and things like that?
Security.
Yeah, and so forth. So think about the job prospects and whether or not it would be a job compatible with you. There might be some really cool things to study in college that don't necessarily translate into much of a job. You know, my daughter-in-law has a degree in music, and she was a secretary to a financial planner for many years. You know, there wasn't much to do in music. It wasn't even music education, so she couldn't even teach it. You know, so it was more like performance, but she wasn't going to do that. So think about what's something you want to do. Maybe you need to go to a trade school or an apprenticeship or something if you like to work with your hands. Maybe you need to go to college and prepare in some way for what you're trying to do. But think about, will there be good job prospects? Will this be something that I can easily, you know, see myself having a career in?
Do you hear what he said? Was that a selfish view of things or a selfless view of things? Why are you picking this field? Right? It's so you can support your family. Is it because, oh, that's what I've always dreamed of doing? It will be fulfilling. That's what I like to do more than anything else, right? You see the difference there? The choice is not made because, and this is what the world will tell you, right? You surely don't want a job that you don't like, right?
If it was fun, they wouldn't pay you for it.
I imagine out in the Depression, you know, some guy's out trying to plow his field and barely make enough for his family to survive, you know, and working from sun up to sundown, and somebody comes up and says, do you like your job? You know, are you fulfilled in your work, you know? But that is the kind of way the world talks to us, and I think we make selfish decisions that way. Yeah. As a leader, you're thinking, okay, what will make me the best dad? What job can do that? One that has security. Maybe one where you make a lot of money. You don't have to work many hours. You can spend time fathering your kids and being a husband to your wife and working in your church. You see what I'm saying? It's a very different worldview about how you make those kind of decisions. And that's kind of related to this question.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm... So can you talk about the relationship between manliness and financial responsibility, independence from parents financially and even where you live, working diligently in your employment? This is with a view to someone, you know, who's, you know, making that transition, maybe first married. And I mean, that's the starting point. It just seems like the starting point is to say, what is your role? Is it to be happy? Is it to be fulfilled? No. And if that's your approach, especially if it's also your wife's approach, that's a recipe for disaster, right? No, the role is I'm a servant, and I'm a strong servant, and I will figure out how to manage the money and how to get a kind of employment. Not that I like the job necessarily, but it's best for my family. You know what I mean? I will manage the affairs of the family to keep them safe and keep them healthy if that's necessary. That's the strength of leadership there. And it's that outward-looking selflessness that God demonstrated toward us, but it also adds that competence, if I want to use that term, you know, of being able to earn a living, or being able to fix the lawnmower, whatever it is, those skills that you need to make life better for your family, not yourself. I don't know if that helped answer that question, but, I mean, an unselfish view of things.
You mentioned college and choosing your dream career. Are there other ways that we want to pinpoint for us when you think the world wants to keep us from maturing into ways that the world kind of stops from growing up to be the kind of thing God wants us to be?
The world would like for us to just stay in our parents' basement and play video games all day and let them take care of us. I mean, I think we need to grow up to be independent, financially independent, and I echo everything Marty said. That was excellent. That's exactly right. I mean, this is not for me to find what I love to do. Most things you love to do, you pay money for, they don't pay you for it. Fine, if you can find a job you like that will support you well and so forth, fine. But most jobs have a lot of aspects to them that aren't a lot of fun. I mean, even if it's an area you enjoy, you're probably going to have a boss that maybe is hard to deal with, or coworkers, or other, you know, situations, circumstances. Jobs aren't always fun. That's not the life we're looking for.
And tacking on to that, we live in a culture, more than perhaps any other time in human history, we have more access to entertainment than any humans before us. We have our phones and our tablets and our TVs, and we can play, you mentioned video games, and that's just one thing that we can do with our time that does not develop us in any kind of meaningful way. I mean, I guess you could argue there's some things that you can get out of video games, I don't know that you can make a strong argument for that. But that's just one example. YouTube videos, just surfing the net, so many things that we do on the internet are maybe not in and of themselves wrong, but they do waste time and they do not develop us as men to be servants. If I'm browsing Apple News on my iPad, I am not helping my wife with the dishes or whatever it is that she might need me to help with around the house. And that's something that in real life, that's what I do sometimes. And that's not showing manhood, that's showing selfishness. So,
it's gospel.
I'm
like to draw a comment on putting things in perspective. Obviously, the spiritual strength is an important thing. But when Paul says to Timothy, by the exercise of the prophet's will, godliness is profitable in all things. Paul's point is this is what's more important. But he does say the prophet's will. I'd like to use two modern and two biblical scenarios that are very quickly uncommon. You're in a dangerous area due to weather, neighborhood, situation on the road, car breaks down. If you don't have the strength to turn the tire on, you know, if you've got a flat tire, you'd be in danger for them. You're on a pipe with your children or wife, house with their own, one of them strains their ankle or breaks their ankle. If you spend your entire life doing this, are you able to carry them? Biblically, if everybody in Nehemiah's time spent all their time doing this, would that wall have built in 58 days? And when the betrothed woman ducks stoned because she did not cry out, it says she's to be killed because she did not cry out so someone could rescue her. Mm-hmm. And so we live in a time, there's a lot of Olympians that are moral wins. We need the focus to be on this. But what about that perspective from First Timothy?
I'll make a couple of comments, but not nearly a complete.
Use the mic.
I'll just say a couple of things about that. I think to some extent, and you mentioned examples of that, but I think a measure of fitness and health is an enabler for all the other spiritual activities as well. It's not just changing the tires. I have the energy to stay up late if I have to and help somebody, right? Or to study or to do whatever I need to. I think if I'm feeling bad, I've got some kind of an ache that's somehow preventable by being active or something like that. And I think a lot of diseases are. Some are not. I'm not trying to address that. I think it's part of the enabling that we have. Just like we look for a job that helps enable the things we want to do, I think it's helpful to be physically fit to be able to do it. Because it affects your mind. It makes you think clearer. You do all those kind of things. You may live longer and maybe be more productive in various ways. There's maybe a second area. I think I was talking to Stephen about this earlier. If you've ever been in an athletic thing, and Paul uses that imagery, right? We looked at that in 1 Corinthians 9 and another, in 2 Timothy 2, he talks about an athlete competing. I think I overheard you saying that Timothy must have kind of maybe been interested in that, right? I don't know if he was too sickly or not, but you know. In fact, I think I read somewhere that Paul was in Corinth potentially during the Corinthian games. Maybe he even made tents that the athletes might have lived in or that were competing there, maybe. So it was a common thing. I think you learn lessons from physical activities and stress and endurance and things like that. I mean, you think about running the race, run with endurance. Those things are images that I think if you haven't pushed yourself maybe in some physical way, you ever been in a race and you just push yourself and you really do more than you thought you could. I don't know why I'm looking at you particularly, but you all have had this experience, right?
Yes.
Where you're just motivated, and that's you I was talking to, isn't it? I think about this. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Push along and you say, I was really capable of way more than I thought. And that lesson and the discipline that Paul talks about here of buffeting your body, that I think can be carried over in other areas. I don't know if I can handle this sadness. I don't know if I can deal with this stress in the church or not that's happening. But somehow I can draw from that experience of an athlete who has the endurance and the strength beyond what he thought because he's motivated. That's a lesson I think we can carry over from the physical side. Remembering what Paul said, profitable for a little. Maybe there are other things too you need to say about it.
It's not so much on the side of stressing yourself, but getting enough sleep at night is just a really practical thing that I did not do a good job of when I was younger. I'm still young, but when I was younger than I am now. And that made me, to some degree, less capable of helping other people and doing the stressful things that would improve my body or mind or whatever.
Discipline.
Or discipline. Yeah, so there's a lot of things that feed into this. that we could talk about, but that definitely some things.
But keep in mind, as God said, on the other hand, discipline yourself for the purpose of godliness, because that's the thing that really matters. So focus primarily on your spiritualism.
Amen.
Yes.
I want to thank the panelists and those of you that paid attention tonight. I'll be honest with you, I wanted to be on the panel. And I had the choice to be on the panel. But I believe that these three men would do a better job than me. And so I chose them. I hope you understand the opportunity that you had, that you paid attention, that you'll think about and make applications. But not only that, one of the purposes of these panels is to introduce you to people and to introduce you to ideas and opportunities that in the future you can reach out to men like these and